You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 231 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you in, as usual, in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the 5-0 Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
There it is. Hope everyone got a chance to listen to our emergency pod after the Seahawks' thrilling 27-26 win over the Minnesota Vikings on Sunday night.
And as always, this podcast is sponsored by our good friends at Pagliacci Pizza.
Do you have a because?
Oh, no.
Pagliacci stays undefeated, and so does the Seattle Seahawks.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. There it is. Well, we are back, I assume, for the last time. I think for the last time.
This is the last podcast ever?
No. We are back one last time.
You're like, do I have a bomb to drop on you?
We're approaching the anniversary, a four-year anniversary of being back, I think.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, coming up on that.
Yeah.
I think this is going to be our last Fremont Fresh Hop beer for 2020.
No. The hops are getting a little bit less fresh.
Yeah, I would think so, yes. So, as I mentioned on last week's podcast, so we had done the Field to Ferment, of course. We had done the Kawichi Canyon. Mm-hmm. We had done the Head Full of Fresh Hops.
Wow.
And then we were informed via Instagram DM, hey, there's another fresh hop beer for you to try. And that is the Hazy Kawichi Canyon Pale Ale. So there we go. It combines the elements, presumably, of the Kawichi Canyon Pale Ale.
All the things. And all the fresh hops have combined into this one fresh hop Pale Ale. You know, it's a modern beer with it being hazy. So these are available in the UBG, as they call it, in crowler form, right?
That is correct.
So we're talking 32 ounces of Fremont Hazy Kawichi Canyon.
It's going
to
be a lot
for each of us to drink here on the podcast.
I make no guarantees, no promises about the second half of tonight's podcast.
I mean, I actually opened it and poured a little bit out for Mrs. Fantasy Genius. That sounds pretty somber. Poured some into a cup for Mrs. Fantasy Genius.
Oh, yeah. And, no, she's still with us. She's good.
And it's great. Like, this is, man, if we're having to rank the Fremont Fresh Hop beers that we've had this year so far, which of course we do, I think this might be number one.
Wow. I'm not as big into hazy beers, I think, as you are. So I think the original flavor Kawichi Canyon is going to be tough to beat for me.
I'm always ahead of the game.
I mean, you certainly are in terms of sour beers. That is
you know,
for
the
sure.
Sour trend never really hit the way that I anticipated it.
I don't think it didn't hit. It didn't take over necessarily.
Yeah, and I will also say I did not predict. I was at Safeway earlier. And I did not predict that basically half of the beer aisle would be hard seltzer.
Well, if you would have predicted that, then you should have started investing in it.
Fremont alcoholic seltzer. Fresh hop alcoholic seltzer. I'll pitch it. Next September.
All right. Well, we are pouring one out this week for a Seattle landmark Elephant Car Wash, which is set to close after operating since 1964 in the South Lake Union area. And coincidentally, as I was driving between Fremont, where I picked up this crowler, and Capitol Hill, where I was picking up Little Woody's, and we'll talk about them in a second here, I drove past the Elephant Car Wash. It was like ideal timing for that. So the iconic sign, neon pink sign that has marked that landmark for nearly six decades, will be donated to Mohai, where it'll be there with the all the Sonic stuff and all the other memories of what once used to be the Seattle.
Uh-huh, our childhood. It'll be there locked away in a closet with the rest of our childhood.
Oh, no. Everything that once made Seattle distinct from San Francisco.
Now it's just the goddamn domes. The spheres. Sorry, the spheres.
If only there was a dome and that dome was where Russell Wilson could play football, but that's a different issue.
Could have had it. I was trying to tell people in the 90s. Keep the dome.
Who knew? We're a visionary.
Is there, looking back on this, what are the iconic landmarks of old Seattle that are really left? Because right now, we were without the Rainier Art, came back. So there was a period of time where there was a giant green tea for some reason. The PI globe, I believe, is still there, but also you're thinking.
Yeah, is the PI globe still there?
Pretty sure the PI globe is still there. It doesn't turn like it used to.
Yeah.
We're now without the elephant car wash. What other landmarks of old Seattle are left?
I was thinking the Hat and Boots, which got moved. I don't know if they're quite big enough to qualify.
Look, if you're talking South Seattle, which of course we are.
Why wouldn't you be?
Yeah, the Hat and Boots. Man, I feel like they've all kind of come and gone. You know, the Hat and Boots, there's now a playground right next to them. And then you look at it, tear in your eyes, you're going down the slide. Your children have no idea why you're so emotional about a giant Hat and Boots.
Wait, did you actually take your kids there?
I mean, it's been a while. It was a couple of years ago. They moved to that playground. We went to the playground that was next to the Hat and Boots. Yes, of course.
For those people who don't know, the Hat and Boots contained a convenience store and restrooms that were like part of a gas station.
Gas station. Okay. Yeah. For the people who don't know, get the fuck out of here. You're listening to the wrong podcast.
Hey, we have a lot of, some of the listener don't know really, you know, I've never been to Seattle even, so they're not going to know the Hat and Boots for sure. The PI Globe is
normal. We're not only being hyper-specific to Seattle, now we're shrinking
South Seattle.
It.
Yeah.
The PI Globe. If you're not from Georgetown, Burien, Boulevard Park, South Park, see ya. See you later. White Center, possibly.
The PI Globe is still there. It is no longer spinning. You are correct. So. That's all I can think of. I mean, I guess if you want to count, well, you can count Hammering Man.
The public market sign, for Pike Place Market. There actually are quite a few that are still there. And obviously the Space Needle being, the biggest and most thriving of the Seattle landmarks.
Oh yeah. That.
So, but again, you know, Mohai is, getting fuller.
It sure is. I mean, hopefully someday we're going to be able to take the Sonic stuff out of storage there, but not yet, as it turns out. Should we talk about Seattle food?
Absolutely, we should.
Okay, we teased this on last week's pod, right?
Sort of.
That there's a new hot chicken spot in downtown Renton, which is part of your discussion.
It was sort of mentioned in what you described as me having, quote, on last week's podcast, a number of prepared rants.
I did say that, yes. That was your rant about Renton, wasn't it?
Which I retorted that none of these rants were prepared.
They were all apparently just freestyle.
What I would describe about Renton is an impassioned plea. Don't reduce it to a rant. Yeah, no. That would be marginalizing what I was saying. During that impassioned plea to Dick's Drive-In to move a location to downtown Renton, number one, do it. Number two, I mentioned that there was hot chicken now in downtown Renton. And somebody asked what the location was. So in the former site of Heaven Sent Fried Chicken, which sadly we pour one out. I don't know if we did that back in the day. We pour one out to Mr. Azell. And the fine people at Heaven Sent Fried Chicken, who definitely make some of the best fried chicken in Seattle.
Does still exist. I'm seeing that there are apparently locations in Everett and Federal Way for Heaven Sent, which I did not know.
Okay, I thought they were just in Everett.
Lake City.
I was going to guess that
Lake City is like
Lake City in there.
The flagship. I've been to that one. This only says their website only says Lake City and Everett. So there you go.
Okay, that makes more sense. So replacing that location was a Nashville-style hot chicken location, because it has to be chicken.
I don't know that I would describe this as Nashville-style. I mean, obviously, hot chicken originates in Nashville. You disagree, or you've gone silent?
I was just looking to see if they specifically themselves described it that way. Yeah. But a hot chicken location, it literally on the sign says Nashville hot fried chicken.
Okay. All right.
Is that not enough for you?
No, that's sufficient.
Okay. Does Dolly Parton have to be in there also? Like, so a Nashville style hot chicken location called Yummy Meats and Deli. And you had picked this up on Saturday night for us.
I did. And so it was a little different than, not that I've had a lot of hot chicken in my life. I mean, the original hot chicken I ever had was Sisters and Brothers, which at the time was in Georgetown, now has moved to Lower Queen Anne.
Location. As we only report on Georgetown on the podcast.
Yeah. We have not yet patronized that no location is. We do not want to endorse their move.
Uh-huh.
Then we had it at Hattie B's in Vegas, right? Mm-hmm. At what is that, block 21 in the Cosmopolitan?
That doesn't sound right to me.
Something like that. It's in the Cosmopolitan, suffice it to say. So as compared to this, I would say the flavor here at Plofile a little different. And I went with the mild because usually hot chicken is extremely spicy. And I am a wuss.
It's got to say hot.
I went to Krispy Kreme last week. That was good. We're not going to review Krispy Kreme.
You also, I'm mostly just upset that you didn't tell me you went to Krispy Kreme.
I probably should have given you the heads up there.
They've got Halloween-themed donuts. You think that's something that I don't want?
That's a fair point.
Kevin Eats has failed.
Well, Kevin Eats got canceled. Kevin Eats came through for you today. We're going to get to that. We did it on Saturday with the hot chicken. I got the mild, and it was not particularly spicy, I would say. Wow. I definitely could have stepped it up at least one level. You got the hot and said I could have easily done that, and there's one in between medium.
That you could have done that, yes.
Correct.
As somebody who has less of a spice tolerance than me. I mean, basically, my thinking is if I'm getting hot fried chicken, I should just get the hot. Like, that's the reason you're there is to get hot chicken. Why not just get hot chicken, you know? And the best description of Nashville style hot chicken is that it should be a 24-hour experience. And
so shouts to Danny Chow.
Absolutely. In the definitive, I think this was for Grantland, right?
No, that was after they became after it was at the Rainier.
Okay. One of the definitive stories on Nashville hot chicken.
Okay. Now here, I've gone to their Instagram page, by the way. And what it says is Nashville hot fried chicken, Szechuan style.
Man, give me that Szechuan style.
We did give it to you. I did. Remember? That's what we're discussing.
I like hearing those words together. It was having Sisters and Brothers hot for the first time. I think it was probably the first hot chicken that I'd ever had. We went in there for dinner, sitting at the bar, get the hot chicken. I'm like, fuck it. We're at a hot chicken place. I'm going to get the hot. I had to order like 9 Rainier Tall Boys to get through that experience. It was just like, keep them coming. As cold as possible, just when I finish this one, give me another one, because I will not be able to tolerate it after that hot. And that was nothing like what this experience was. It was hot. It was hot. It was spicy, the hot, but it wasn't like, it was definitely not unbearable. It was honestly like, it was equivalent to probably a mild at Sisters and Brothers.
I think that's fair. The main thing that stood out, so we both got the chicken sandwiches, was the size of the chicken breast in the chicken sandwich, which was pounded thin. And
so it's a breast pounded thin. This isn't a thigh.
Yes.
Okay.
And dramatically exceeded the size of the bun. Like, you had a significant amount of chicken. I ate that part first before eating the rest of it with the bun. And that was like a lot of food in and of itself.
Yes. Very large. I'm not going to lie. I know I might sound like a heretic here. Sometimes there's too much chicken. Like, the thing about
proportions... Because you thought the ratio was off?
Things have to be right. That's the thing. More is not always better. Not that the chicken tasted bad, but, like, I want most of the bites to be contained within the sandwich. And so, like, if you take the Maono chicken sandwich, which I think we both agree is the perfect chicken sandwich,
I did everything, declare it's the best in the world on Saturday.
Yeah, I'm a little. As I said to you when you said that was the best in the world, it's like the best chicken sandwich in the world. I can almost guarantee you is not located in Seattle, Washington. Sorry, but they have a location in West Seattle, so we could still cover it just barely. If they were in Georgetown, maybe it'd be the best location in the world or the best chicken sandwich in the world. But it's like, I want to get to the sandwich, right? Like, you almost have to have one or two bites of chicken outside of the sandwich before you get to the sandwich. And it's like, I'm here for the sandwich. Just give me the show. I don't need an opener, right?
I suppose so.
You don't agree with this perspective?
I don't disagree with this perspective. You could almost put a second bun on there. Like, if you had your own bun and just put it on there and make two sandwiches out of it.
Yeah,
frankly.
I mean, definitely could do that. Slice it off. I think in general, like, the sandwich was good. I don't have any particular complaints about it, but it also didn't stand out to me so much that it was like, oh crap, this is one of the best chicken sandwiches I've had.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was in the mix with the other chicken sandwiches we've had over the course of this summer.
Yeah.
I would put it ahead of Milk Drunk for sure. I'd probably have to try more to see vis-a-vis Jack's Chicken Shack.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's all...
Was there another chicken that we had? Oh, yeah, the...
Yes.
Cookies.
Yeah.
I think possibly ahead of that, too. The advice I got when I went to pick this up that I wish I had known beforehand is apparently if you go to their Instagram, which is at Yummy Meats and Deli and spelled out there, they regularly post a discount code that you can apply if you order online to get 10% off. So that's a nice benefit. And I would say the other thing, by the way, the size of the sandwich is so large, you don't even really need sides. And I would say the sandwich was better than the mac and cheese, which is the side that we had.
I agree.
So there's a review. We mentioned earlier.
There's a review.
Not like that as a transition. We mentioned earlier, going to Little Woody's earlier. It's week two of fast food month. Sadly, you have missed out. If you didn't get the Woody's Baconator, you've missed out. But it is time for the Sourdough Woody. This is one that I have had in the past. But let's be clear here. I enjoy the sourdough, Woody. The real reason I'm going right now is for the curly fries.
Yep.
I love a curly fry.
Oh, man. I would say I'm not a curly fry stan. I would actually almost say that curly fries are like fairly low on my fry list if I'm doing a fry ranking.
We're not
doing right now because we haven't had time to prepare for it. And I'll need 6 to 8 weeks to prepare for that. But these curly fries were not only the best curly fries I've ever had, they were some of the best fries that I've had.
Wow.
I had them hours after you would pick them up, right?
Yeah, at least a solid hour after I picked them up.
I think maybe a curly fry like preserves a little bit better than normal fry does.
Curly fry can be soggy. Yeah. There's still a crunch to it that you're not going to get with a regular fry.
They were very good. And I think it's the interesting thing to judge during Little Woody's fast food month is this item better than the original? And to me, the curly fries just destroy Jack in the Box curly fries.
That's interesting. I don't feel like that's ever in question. But maybe with the crisp burrito, just because of the fact that Taco Time is so good that
you don't think that's ever in question. This is not an insult to Little Woody's, but sometimes the burgers that you're getting are better off with a less good burger patty. Like the third pound Painted Hills beef or whatever, it like just doesn't work with the burger. You know what I mean? There are times
that.
Where the burger stands out a little bit too much in a way. I'm not saying that this was the case here, but like I asked Mrs. Fantasy Genius how she would rate the Sourdough Jack versus the Sourdough Woody. And to her, she said, far and away, the sourdough woody was better.
I mean, I don't know if I've ever, like I said, I don't know if I've ever had a sourdough jack in my life. It's not something I would order. I've always been a jumbo jack guy at Jack in the Box.
No cheese. I need cheese on there.
You can add cheese, can't you?
Yeah, you can. Sure.
It's hard for me to imagine that it would match. I get what you're saying about it's kind of more burger forward than some fast food places are going to have, but those kind of burgers, it's not like Lil Woody's is doing a McDonald's cheeseburger.
Yeah. I've actually been pretty disgusted with fast food burgers lately. There's something about, honestly, like I mentioned this before, but watching that The Founder movie, and then I had like a McDonald's cheeseburger, I was like, I'm pretty disgusted by these burger patties. Like, seeing what Dix is doing, or a Lil Woody's or whatever, with like real burgers cooked on a grill, it's kind of hard to turn back. And it's amazing that it's taken me 35 years to get here, and definitely a sign that I'm getting old. But
I got there a little earlier than you did in terms of age.
There's, even if I'm having a fast food burger, I'm like, man, I, for the first time in my life, I've craved a fancier McDonald's burger than like a double cheeseburger or whatever. Those patties are just like, they're fucking disgusting.
And yet still much love for the Wendy's 4 for $4.
Oh, look, the Wendy's 4 for $4. No. This is not a conversation we're having. Junior bacon cheeseburger and the Wendy's 4 for $4 is perfection. But there's something about like a McDonald's cheeseburger or a McDonald's double cheeseburger where I just literally the visual of seeing a real burger cooked on a grill like they do at Dick's, when you watch them in the back and you're just like, damn, like that's hot. You know, it's like, wow, that is a real burger being cooked and it looks good. And thinking about that, you know, when you just get an image in your mind, and like having Dick's a couple of weeks ago, it's like, these are just, it's just good. This is a good burger.
This is Lil Woody's.
And Lil Woody's. Like, the Lil Woody's burger patty is different, though. It's not a fast food burger.
Yes.
Like, this is, it's a large piece of meat.
It's a substantial burger. I thought
overall is great, though.
The quantity of the curly fries is incredible.
Always. The quantity of the fries in general at Lil Woody's is always immense. So my favorite things about the sourdough jack are, and the sourdough woody, the combination of ketchup and mayonnaise together with the tomato. Mrs. Fantasy Genius is coming back for more of this beer. That's what I was saying. Okay. That beer.
There you go. I feel like it might be a solid number two for me.
The beer?
Yeah, among the fresh hops.
Clear number one. But your review is that the bun was toasted much better, right? What? What then?
You said.
Come here.
You said that the bun was not toasted well enough on the Lil Woody's version. And I said, neither of them are toasted as they are not supposed to be.
Well, there you go.
Do you think that they're supposed to be toasted?
Again, I've never had a sourdough jack that I know of, so it's tough for me to say. It did look, I'll admit, a little more toasted in the photo of the sourdough woody than the version that we got. But I didn't miss it, necessarily. I think it just didn't photograph as well.
Toasting. Okay.
Look, the toasty I like to do is with a fresh hop beer.
There we go. So what do we have coming up next week for Lil Woody's Fast Food Month?
Well, next week, first off, this is the first day of the sourdough woody. So you got a full 6 days here to go get that before next Monday. But next Tuesday, our next stop will be the classic, the Lil Big Mac.
Wow. I don't know if I've ever had a Lil Big Mac.
There is a photo of Babyest Fantasy Genius eating Lil Woody's that is, I guarantee you, with the Lil Big Mac. He's eating a French fry, I think, but I guarantee you.
I think you might be wrong about that.
To the White Center location together to have the Lil Big Mac. I'm sure of it.
I think that was a different burger.
You're going to trust your memory over me?
This is on the Pumpcast Instagram.
I think it might have been your personal Instagram, but I'm not sure.
It's definitely not on my personal Instagram. And look, if you're not following the podcast on Instagram, what even are you doing? All the updates on the food that we're eating, pictures of us in aprons, everything is there.
I guess if that's everything, then yes, everything is in fact there. Okay, I think that covers us as far as Seattle food. Look forward to Fast Food Month continuing. Ella Woody's.
That's time. Podcast on Instagram.
Yes. Now it's time for our NBA.
There's a lot of teriyaki on here.
There is. That's true. It's time for our NBA Seattle update. The NBA season is over. I don't know if you're aware of this.
That's it. Still no team in Seattle. Yeah. Anyway, that thus concludes our NBA Seattle update.
Oh, no. Oh, no. You wanted to talk about the offseason timing, didn't you?
I wanted to talk more about this picture you're talking about because... Wow. Okay, hold on. Let me see here.
There's some
fry sauce going on here. You can't really tell. Had to get the little Big Mac at Lil Woody's and teach the next generation that the most important part of a burger is the secret sauce.
What? Oh, why do you ever question me? You know my memory.
And this was 107 weeks ago.
You think that's going to stop me?
September. So burger fast food month used to be in September.
Yeah, they did move it back a little bit.
September 21st, 2018. Hashtag Lil Woody's is for the children. Oh, man. Well, I guess I will take my defeat.
Would you like to do the little gesture to hold your L like Mina Kimes did today on NFL Live? Which I loved because my favorite part of that is she was being so gentle, as if the L was a butterfly that she might crush.
What was she taking the L for?
Justin Herbert being good. Which
she said Justin Herbert wouldn't be good.
I mean, I 100% we are also taking that L.
Low key, can we talk about Justin Herbert? I mean, you shouldn't take an L after four starts. But
yeah, that is the thing.
B, it is wild how quickly you can go from hating a player to really loving a player once they get to the NFL. Where it's I cannot believe how much I'm cheering for Justin Herbert now. This is the exact same human being. When he's at Oregon, I'm just God, I hate his face. And then he's in the NFL, and I'm man, that Justin Herbert, I fucking love him. It is really wild where I wholeheartedly cheering for Justin Herbert starting from the first moment for some reason. I don't even really comprehend why, but seeing him against Breeze on Monday night, I was go Chargers, right?
Especially you put him in the Powder Blues.
He ended up at a pretty lovable organization, I'll say.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I don't think this is Humillan eat your hat type situation yet. It's been four games, and he's actually 0-4. Herbert's looked good, but he still hasn't won a game yet.
Oh, hard luck, 0-4.
But you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's a little early, but anyways, that's what you were.
That's really funny. All right,
what were we talking about?
I've had the little Big Mac.
We were talking about the NBA offseason.
Okay, so
you were curious about the timing of it.
And I thought instead of asking you personally, I would.
Oh, we got to do it on a podcast.
Conversation. Yeah.
Well, as you know, we never speak outside the podcast now, so that we can have all our conversations. We'll be fresh when we have them.
Yes. So I think first off, a congrats is in order to the Lakers. This was their season. And it felt like they were destined to win this year. They knocked the Blazers out of the playoffs. It was one of those situations where...
I don't know if that's when we knew they were destined to win, but yes.
I'm just saying, as we were following the Blazers closely, they were the team that did knock the Blazers out of the playoffs. And relatively comfortable victories in every round. So now that the bubble is closed, things are wrapped up. It's a unique offseason. I mean, we're sitting here on October 13th with the draft ahead of us, which is a wild situation. So for people like us who are not paying that close of attention, what is the timing of this offseason heading into what will likely be the 2021 season?
Yeah, it's very unlikely at this point it would start within calendar 2020. The only thing that we know for sure is the draft, which is set for November 18th at this point. Michelle Roberts did an interview last week with The Athletic where she said that free agency would start no later than December 1st. And we've also seen a report this week that Adam Silver basically gave the employees at the NBA league office off Thanksgiving weekend off entirely.
Thanksgiving week off, right?
Something like that. Yeah. So it's clearly going to
Thanksgiving
happen.
Weekend. They should already have off.
Well, yes. Okay. Thanksgiving week.
So what kind of labor practices are being practiced in the NBA?
Look,
you're getting Thursday, Friday, take them all.
So that does not leave very long between Thanksgiving weekend and December 1st. It basically seems like free agency is going to start on Monday, November 30th, in all likelihood.
Okay.
And then at some point we'll have a training camp. And the expectation at this point within league circles is that the season will begin on MLK Day, as we talked about last week, which is January 18th. So there you go.
For the Blazers, I know that we wrapped up their season and what we discussed in way too in depth, players that they may be looking for in the offseason. You threw out a bunch of names of horrible players.
Can I give you another name that we talked about in the group chat lately last week that we decided was a perfect fit for the Blazers?
Who was that? I don't think I saw this. What group chat are we talking about?
Oh, this is my NBA group chat.
I'm not in that one.
You're not in
the group chat. I assume this is a group chat that I was a part of. Okay.
At least Enes Kanter?
Enes Kanter?
Bring back Kanter.
I don't.
The Celtics are going to be looking to dump him because they have luxury tax issues. Might be willing to give up a first round pick to do it because they have three of those.
Really?
Yeah. So the Blazers can get Kanter back, and they love Kanter, and get a first round pick out of it potentially.
Man, like, now you're kind of piquing my interest here.
Yeah.
Of
course.
If you're. There are a lot of situations where if you can get a first round pick to take on a player, you should probably just do that.
And they have a trade exception from the Kent Bazemore Trevor Ariza trade that would allow them to do this.
Is Ariza going to be back? Is he under contract on the Blazers next year?
So his contract is, I believe, $2 million guaranteed off the top of my head of the $12.8 million he's due. One way or another, I think he's probably going to be back, whether they decide to guarantee that or were to waive him and just re-sign him using the non-tax mid-level exception, but it's probably easier for them to just keep him.
Feels like a lot for Trevor Ariza.
It's a lot, and definitely more than he would get on the open market, but it's a little bit easier for them to just keep him because then they can use their mid-level to, you know, if they need to re-sign Melo for the more than the minimum, to sign their draft pick for...
How old is this team?
Well, they're getting a first-round pick, a second first-round pick in my scenario here.
There you go. The youth movement is starting with this first round pick they get from Enes Kanter.
So.
Huh.
That's how I'm thinking about it right now.
Okay. Do they currently have their own first round pick?
They do. Yeah.
Okay.
I think they have all of their
first round
picks. They
would be looking at having
forward.
A couple of later first round picks, but not terrible.
Well, they have 15 or maybe 16. I think 15.
That's their own pick. So it's not a bad pick.
No. That'll be their highest pick since Zach Collins, I think.
Wow. All right.
So it's good. There'll be some interesting aspects to this offseason for the Blazers.
No, I mean, I like the place that they're in, where they're still... Simons didn't pan out this year necessarily the way that we anticipated he would, but I'm not giving up on Anfernee Simons. Gary Trent definitely is somebody who sort of broke out in the bubble. I think we could possibly expect a little bit more from next year. Getting a healthy Nurk for the entire year, plus Ariza back. They basically have very old players, very young players, and Dame Lillard and CJ McCollum. Right?
I mean, Nurk's in the middle, too.
And also, if they can have 100% healthy CJ and Dame and Nurk for a year, like that would be monster.
I mean, the West is going to be just loaded next year, but the Blazers should be better than they were this season.
All right. Well, I'm ready for the NBA draft the week before Thanksgiving.
It's going to be so weird.
Duncan's not going to be able to rank Thanksgiving foods with us this year.
Well, we can always replay that one. That's a classic. It's timeless.
He'll be busy.
on to the Seattle Sounders, who are coming off a week that saw them win at home 2-1 on Wednesday over Real Salt Lake and then lose 3-1 on Sunday at LAFC, a game I'm sure you paid a lot of attention to.
I literally had no idea that game was happening.
As it occurred opposite both Game 6 of the NBA Finals and Seahawks on Sunday Night Football.
Wow.
There was a lot going on. Had a lot of screens in effect.
If a Sounders match happens in the woods and nobody sees it,
that would be if they played in Portland. Wednesday was Brian Schmetzer's 400th career match as Sounders head coach, including all competitions, friendlies, and both the USL era and his current stint as MLS head coach.
There we go. 400th match.
Yeah. Much love to Schmetzer. Remember when people wanted him to be fired a couple years ago? I was thinking about that. That didn't age well. The Sounders took the lead through Jordan Morris, set up by Christian Roldan in the 28th minute, adding an insurance goal from Yaimar Gomez Andrade on a header off of Nico Ladero service in the 61st minute. And that second goal proved important when they conceded a Nuhu own goal in the 68th minute. But we're still able to get full points. They'll rue the missed opportunities in Sunday's match, their first loss to LAFC of the restart after two wins at CenturyLink Field. They conceded in the 15th minute off a free kick and fell behind 2-0 in the 66th minute before scoring their lone goal in the 77th minute on a Nico Ladero free kick. Danny Masovski scored his second goal of the match in the 84th minute to kill off the game, despite the fact that the Sounders doubled LAFC in shot-based expected goals according to 538's model and nearly doubled them in non-shot expected goals as well. So not really as disappointing an outcome as it kind of looks on the scoreline.
That model factor in New York Times full page headlines.
That's the Galaxy and Zlatan no longer plays for them. Remember? He's gone.
No. You don't understand.
What?
About what the 538 presidential model is factoring in.
Yeah, yes. Okay. I get your joke. I was thinking of full page ad from Zlatan. The loss dropped the Sounders back into a tie with Portland atop the Western Conference, this time without a match in hand. Still dominant in goal differential, doubling up the Timbers at plus 18 to their plus 9, and they host the final head-to-head matchup between those two teams. So 538's model gives them a 55% chance of finishing atop the West.
What does it mean to finish atop the West? Like, what is the benefit to that versus being second?
You host the conference championship if you get that far and play the 8th seed and the 4th seed instead of the 7th seed and the 3rd seed. It's not as big of a deal as it used to be. There's no buys anymore.
Yeah.
The Sounders match on Wednesday against the Colorado Rapids has been postponed because of an outbreak on the Rapids, who last played September 23rd. They haven't had a positive test since, I believe, last Friday, but because of the fact that they have obviously been unable to train, they have postponed their next 3 matches in addition to the last 4 because they've had 12 total staff members and 5 players who have tested positive. It is impossible to make up the game based on the current schedule. Because the Sounders don't have any open dates. ESPN's Jeff Carlisle reported Tuesday that the MLS is not considering moving back MLS Cup from its scheduled date of December 12th and will use points per game instead of total points if teams are unable to play a full schedule. There is some possibility
totally normal stuff.
There is some possibility that they might play the week between the current scheduled end of the regular season, which I believe is November 12th, doing this off the top of my head. No, I guess that can't be it. Is it? I don't know. Maybe it is. And when the playoffs were scheduled, or November 8th, I think is when the scheduled end of the regular season is. No, that doesn't. Yeah, that works. November 8th is the schedule, and November 20th is the start of the playoffs. So there's an international break in there. That was on November 12th, where they could play some of these matches, but don't ideally want to do that. So we'll see. On Sunday, the Sounders will travel to face the San Jose Earthquakes, who are improbably in playoff position despite their tied for MLS worst minus 19 goal differential. San Jose has given up goals in bunches, including 7 in their last meeting with the Sounders, 6 to the Timbers, 5 apiece to Colorado in their last match before the outbreak, and LAFC, but also pulling out a bunch of one-goal wins. The Earthquakes coming off a 3-0 loss in Portland.
It is
on
a good thing
Sunday.
That we don't host an Earthquakes podcast.
Oh boy, they're XG's.
San Jose, the hate that you would be accused of spreading about the San Jose Earthquakes would be impeccable.
What would be the name of our Earthquakes podcast? Magnitude 11?
Sure.
We'll workshop that. So the Sounders should win this match. In troubling news, Sounders striker Raul Ruiz Diaz tested positive for COVID-19 while with the Peru national team. He had started his match Thursday versus Paraguay that finished as a 2-2 draw. When you look at the time that it's going to take him to get healthy, then the 10-day quarantine after he returns to the U.S., which is a little odd because we would know at that point, presumably, that he's not infectious, but apparently will still imply, it seems unlikely that Ruiz Diaz will play the rest of the MLS regular season.
Well, I mean, I guess most importantly, you know, we hope that Will is healthy and, you know, gets through this without any sort of short-term or long-term damage to his body.
The statement released by the national team, the Peru national team, indicated that he was, and the other player who tested positive for them, were not currently symptomatic. So hopefully that's a good sign that it's not a serious case. OL Reign coming off a 2-1 loss Saturday to the Portland Thorns. Both of those goals for Portland coming on PKs for Christine Sinclair, giving her 5 total goals in 2 matches versus the Reign in the NWSL Fall Series. The second in the 73rd minute decided a game that was tied 1-1 at halftime. The victory clinched the Verizon Community Shield for Portland. The Reign will try to avoid finishing in the cellar in the Fall Series standings in their final game at Saturday at home against the Utah Royals, whom they drew earlier in Utah.
And they played every match this year without Megan Rapinoe, right?
Correct.
So
she was much too busy in the wobble, which transitions us to talking about the Storm off season. They celebrated their championship with a virtual celebration on Friday afternoon. I got to say, not quite the same as a parade, it turns out. what are you going to do during a pandemic? All right, anyways, the Storm offseason. I wrote about this for ESPN.com earlier this week. They are facing a bit of a salary cap crunch because they're going to have several key free agents this offseason. Sue Bird is a free agent. Don't think she's going anywhere at this stage. And then two other starters, Alicia Clark and Natasha Howard. And that's significant because Sue was a free agent last offseason and was already making the new higher WNBA maximum. But Natasha Howard was making the old maximum, which was $117,000, and now can go up to $190,000 to $215,000, depending on whether she signs a supermax or not, which she could only sign with the Storm. And Alicia Clark was making less than $100,000 last year, has a chance to, you know, basically double, more than double her salary as a free agent coming off this great season that she had. And then Sammy Whitcomb is a restricted free agent after making the minimum, you know, dating back to someone who made the team as an undrafted rookie. So they can't realistically bring all of those players back.
Are you saying that Alicia Clark is leaving?
I think we'll see. First off, they're Alicia and Natasha Howard are unrestricted free agents. So unless the Storm decides to core them, which would guarantee them at least a 1-year deal at the maximum salary, it's basically the WNBA's franchise tag. And we'll see. They may want to save that for Breanna Stewart in 2021 when she hits free agency, although she also probably is not going anywhere. So they maybe could use that. But I think those players will probably be back
annually.
Well, if you sign them to you can use that annually, but if you sign one of them to a multi-year deal on the core, then you wouldn't be able to use it. If you sign them to a multi-year deal, it applies all the years that they're on that deal.
That's kind of dumb. Okay.
I think it makes sense. So I think at this point, if I had to guess, I would say that Sammy Whitcomb is the most likely to not be back. And the bench would have a different look this next year because the Storm would have to go pretty cheap on the bench if they're going to have 4 max players in their starting lineup. And you probably would be looking at Epiphany Prince not being able to come back as a free agent. And then Crystal Langhorne and Morgan Tuck have non-guaranteed salaries that would be too high for them to be on the bench. So you'd be looking at a much younger bench next year with Kit Loxa, who was their first round pick this year, who stayed overseas, and then next year's first round pick as well.
What about Izzy Megbogor?
I mean, she's definitely... I mean, I guess the one question next year is the Olympics. Australian players, you know, sometimes stay home at least prior to the Olympics. We saw this with Lauren Jackson many times. That would be the one question mark with her. But she's under contract. She was just finishing the first year of her four-year rookie contract. So she'll be part of the plans.
And they're Australian?
Is he?
Yeah.
Is he is Australian, yes.
Okay.
Is this Sammy Wickham?
A lot of Australians on this team.
Yeah, okay. Storm has a strong history of Australians.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, you know, it'll be a while till we get around to that. Free agency starts in January, but we will continue to monitor all of it.
I mean, that's the best case scenario, what you're describing, though. Like, if we're being honest, if you can keep Alicia Clark and Natasha Howard, but lose Sammy Whitcomb, it's a trade-off that you're going to make.
We did see them win all three games in the finals pretty comfortably without Sammy Whitcomb.
Yes. Not that we don't love Sammy Whitcomb.
Obviously, it would be very disappointing, but also a chance maybe for her to play a larger role somewhere else, which would be kind of cool. UW football began contact practices on Friday. Jimmy Lake and then John Donovan, the new offensive coordinator, neither of them have offered any hints on the quarterback battle. Donovan said Tuesday that all four quarterbacks who are in competition are sharing snaps equally. So they're just not going to tip their hand at all at this point. We did learn last week that two players have opted out of the season, which all players had the ability to do without any sort of penalty to them. Tight end Jacob Kaiser and defensive back Isaiah Gilchrist, both of them seniors.
Have we seen any indication that Levi Onwuzurike or Joe Tryon are coming back?
No indication of that, no.
All right. Well,
there have been some.
We love you, Joe Tryon. Have a great NFL career.
Yeah, Redden's finest. We have seen some opt back ins elsewhere in the Pac-12, but no indication of that with those two players.
Who have we seen? Pine Sewell?
I don't know if I know all the players, but it seems like some Oregon guys, some other players.
I mean, he's top five pick in the draft.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we continue our look back at the 2000 Huskies. Let's remember season. And
I want to say one more thing about the current roster, because Baby Fantasy Genius and I downloaded the NCAA Football 14 2020 rosters, and scrolling through them, they were, I thought, quite well done in general from whomever did them, Go Dogs 14 or whatever. This is for the Georgia Bulldogs. The one thing that stood out to me about this Husky roster, because, you know, we're not going to know it that well at this point, right? Like, there's a lot of players that I could quiz you about that you probably don't remember that well. Just how young of a team Jimmy Lake is inheriting. And especially, I mean, really throughout the team, but especially on defense. Like, this is more than any time in Chris Peterson's tenure, possibly maybe even going back to Coach Sark's first year, this is the biggest rebuild that the Huskies have had to do.
And so, I think the expectations are commensurate with that. You know, the Pac-12, I think there was the media poll. I'm not sure if it might have been the coaches' poll. I think had them third in the North and sixth overall. So which is lower expectations than we've seen in recent years.
They're not terrible expectations. Like, that's not...
No.
It's not a bad season, but there are so many unknowns going into this Husky season, more so than there've been for a significant amount of time for Husky football. Even beyond, there's times we didn't know who the quarterback would be necessarily, but or they were starting a true freshman like Jake Browning. This roster, when you look at the opt-outs that they've had, some of the more experienced defensive players opting out, it's pretty brand new a lot of places. You're looking at like Richard Newton and Kate Otten, you know, as far as players who've really had a significant impact on the team, Puka Nacua, right? Like,
yeah, I think the wide receiver core is pretty similar to last year. I think you're overstating this a tad bit.
But it's a lot of sophomores, some freshmen, a lot of juniors. Like, this is not an experienced team that the Huskies are bringing back. And I think throughout this year, we're really going to see the building blocks of what will probably be the next great Husky team, whether that happens this year or in 2-3 years from now. I think if you were to, quote unquote, like, punt a year, this is the right one to do it.
Well, it's barely a year. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think they're
exactly
punting a year.
Not punting. If you were to have a year where you were inexperienced, though, and you just need to build up some experience and you have very low expectations, this is the right year for that to happen.
But I was aware of that because on The Athletic Seattle today, Christian Capel wrote a piece about UW senior class, which consists of 10 players. It's not exceptionally large. And the junior class is smallish as well, because you know, one of the things that happened is when the redshirt rule came in, where you were allowed to play up to 4 games without burning a season of eligibility, the Huskies redshirted literally every freshman on the roster that year, that class. So, you know, that's the big part of it, where I'm sure they weren't the only team.
You have a ton of sophomores because that.
I think it's the sophomore class that's the one that was the first one impacted by that. But basically, there's probably, I think all of college football, there's going to be a change because of that, where you're going to have more experience in your eligibility because you got to play up to 4 years that redshirt season. And then B, a bunch of teams probably took advantage of that to not burn a year of eligibility with those players.
That's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. All right. Anyways, as we turn our attention back to the 2000 Huskies, we reach maybe the most important moment in that season. And it happened in the game at Stanford, which is when late in the third quarter, Husky safety Curtis Williams was going to tackle Stanford running back Kerry Carter, and they had helmet-to-helmet contact, and Curtis Williams suffered, you know, basically the most horrific injury a football player can suffer. We talked about the Dak Prescott injury last week, and, you know, as tough as that was to watch, it's something that the expectation and the talk now is he's going to be back in 4 to 6 months. And we've seen players return from that injury. But in this case, Williams suffered damage to the C1 and C2 vertebrae at the top of the back and was paralyzed from the neck down from that collision. Do you remember this game?
I think I do.
It's tough to say whether you remember or you remember remembering.
I mean, I probably do more so than almost any other game that year, aside from maybe not even watching the Apple Cup, but from knowing what was going on in the Apple Cup and then also the Rose Bowl. This is one that mentally we've revisited so many times, and I think it's one of those things that stands out to you as, like, you know, I mean, whatever, I was 15 at the time, like, didn't really have that great of a perspective or worldview. But to me, the two worst moments that I feel like we've seen when watching football with your home team or whatever are this and then the Ricardo Lockett play that happened.
Yep.
And which ended Ricardo Lockett's career. It seems like Ricardo Lockett is maybe doing all right right now. And obviously this was devastating. I mean, I think on so many different levels, and it's something that might have even framed a whole perspective about football and college football in general, where, like, this was an quote unquote amateur football player who had such a devastating thing happen to them and then lost their life because of this sport, it's something that's kind of unforgivable long term as far as the approach to how we're treating college athletes in general, right? Like, a free education didn't mean shit to Curtis Williams, you know? And it's something that his fellow student athletes, you know, people on the rowing team or whatever, other students at UW, are not going through a similar experience to what happened here, right? Like, they're not risking their lives to do what they're doing, basketball players even, right? It is a unique experience that you face as a college football player. And both the, like, and we've seen it in other scenarios too, of players who maybe it wasn't that they were putting their life on the line, but they were putting, imagine if something like what happened to Dak Prescott happened in college. It would be that much more. I mean, Tua is the kind of the most natural comparable and seems to have recovered from that fairly quickly. But that you're out there risking your life to do this and getting so little in return.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of my hopes is that this kind of injury is less likely now because of the way the sport of football has changed, where we've done a lot to legislate helmet-to-helmet contact out of the game, but also just the style of tackling has changed. And one of the remarkable things is Kerry Carter, who was a Stanford running back on this play, he now works at Atavis, the Seattle company that is basically trying to bring rugby-style tackling to football, and has worked with the Seahawks and the NFL and has done a lot to make that kind of contact safer. Now, that doesn't mean that the sport itself is safe. And one thing we've learned in the past 20 years is that it's not just plays like this that threaten players' health and safety. It's the impact of all these, you know, the play-to-play helmet contact that especially adds up over time.
Yes.
Yeah. But
I think that this affected Kerry Carter an immense amount. I remember seeing when he was playing for the Seahawks. And it's, this isn't Kerry Carter's fault, right? Like, Kerry Carter didn't do anything wrong on this play. And you watch it, it's sort of a freak thing.
Did you watch it?
I saw a replay of it maybe 2 weeks ago.
I just randomly
seeing a recap of the season. I guess it was a little bit more than that. At some point over the summer, though, falling asleep and waking up to Fox Sports was showing a recap of this season.
Uh-huh.
And obviously this was like a focal point of it. And, you know, they treat it as an uplifting story. And I think maybe it was perceived that way by the team. In the end, I don't think there are almost any positives to take from it. But
it was certainly easier while he was still alive. I mean, we should probably flesh out this story. They, you know, didn't know immediately that it was going to be paralysis. I couldn't find, going through the Seattle Times archive, any one point where kind of people realized that this was going to be the case, but eventually it became clear. Williams did attend the Rose Bowl in a wheelchair, and he returned to Seattle for the first time in April 2002, which would have been about a year and a half after this collision, but tragically died in his sleep the following month, shortly after his 24th birthday.
But you watch the play, and it's not like, it wasn't a violent hit. Again, it was a freak play that happened. And, you know, when you have players who are moving at the speed and with the helmets and gear that they have, it's something that is within the realm of possibility. It's extraordinarily unlikely. But looking at football at every single level of the sport, if there are that many games happening. I mean, there was a player at Taiyi High School at my alma mater the year or two after I was there who died from a hit. And it's not like nobody did anything wrong. The only thing they were doing was playing the sport with this equipment.
Yeah.
And I know that the coach on the team at the time, he's somebody who, similar to Kerry Carter, was haunted by this for years, right? And they didn't call a play that was intentionally asking for this to happen. The thing that they did was being involved in a sport that can be dangerous. You know, it can be mildly dangerous, like Dak Prescott, who will recover from this, and it wasn't a head injury. Or it can be life-threatening. And it's a reality that basically everybody has to face when playing the sport.
Or when kind of affiliated with the sport, supporting the sport, any of that. This is the point where we should talk about the 2008 Seattle Times story about this 2000 Husky team, Victory in Ruins, which was done by investigative reporter Ken Armstrong and higher education reporter Nick Perry, who won both the Michael Kelly and George Polk Journalism Awards for their work. As part of this series, they reviewed the criminal records of members of the 2000 Huskies, including Curtis Williams, who pled guilty to felony third-degree assault in September 1997 for domestic violence against his wife, Michelle.
Curtis Williams was married in 1997?
He had a kid at age 16. They were married, I believe, at age 18. Yeah, wow. Before he came to UW. After two previous misdemeanor assault charges were dropped, and at the start of the 2000 season, he had been under a warrant for missing child support payments, which was resolved prior to his injury. And
why is that relevant? I'm just asking you right now, like, why is this even something that we're bringing up?
I think, one of the criticisms of this series from particularly people within the team was two things. Number one, that this series, which we'll talk a little bit more about in a second, painted the entire team is involved in this behavior as opposed to, you know, a handful of players. And then number two, of course, that you're bringing this up after Curtis Williams' death when he has no ability to respond. And to me, one of the tragedies is, you know, I don't want to be trite about, you know, oh, he could have gotten past it and made up for it, because it's not like an innocent mistake as a child. These are serious things, but he didn't have the chance to continue his life and have a full life in the way that other people have that opportunity. Mm-hmm. So, but I do think we need to talk about the full picture, because especially one of the things they do make painfully clear in this series is that, you know, at the time, media not only dismissed these, not only ignored these things, it outright dismissed them. Like there was one, you know, reference at the time in the local media that said, you know, there was a lot of references to it just being a bad marriage, which is not an acceptable way to talk about domestic violence. And one reference to her being more abusive to him than he was, which is also something that's not acceptable. I mean, one of the things I think about looking back is just all the different ways that our perspective has evolved in the past 20 years in terms of first taking domestic violence seriously, taking sexual assault more seriously generally within the country, specifically on college campuses, and even more specifically in athletic departments, and the way it was covered up for a long period of time. But then also what we've learned about, you know, head trauma and CTE and the role that this often plays in these off-field incidents. So it's like so many layers of complexity. And I feel like one of the things about Curtis Williams looking back on this is every issue you have with the NCAA is wrapped up within Curtis Williams' story. So other features.
The head trauma issue is not an NCAA issue. It is a sport of football issue.
But it's different when you're getting compensated for it by the NFL.
Yes.
And it's different when it's adults rather than 18-year-olds. Like, it's people that are able to make that decision a little more, you know, understand the long-term ramifications of it in a different way. Other features in the Victory and Ruin series highlighted tight end Jeremy Stevens, who was arrested on suspicion of rape prior to the 2000 season, but not charged despite eyewitness testimony corroborating that the victim was incapable of giving consent in that case. And linebacker Jeremiah Farms, who pled guilty in 2001 to robbery of a marijuana dealer, which resulted in the victim being shot in the scuffle, although there were no charges as far as the shooting, in the spring of 2000 before this season. As well as Anthony Kelly, another linebacker who arrived at UW ineligible to play due to the controversial Proposition 48 rule regarding minimum GPA and SAT/ACT scores for athletes, before finding a passion for academics at UW, including a trip to South Africa that he took as a student that was, according to the article, somewhat dissuaded by the UW coaching staff, which wanted him to maintain his focus on football. Kelly is now the director of student diversity and outreach at WSU Vancouver.
Pretty cool. Look at AK-47.
Yeah. So,
I mean, part of that is, and look, I don't know anything about the situation regarding Curtis Williams, but what you're talking about with Anthony Kelly is a person who in these formative years, learn more and change as a person, as all of us did, you know, as an 18 to 22 year old. And in this scenario, I think they just, Curtis Williams never had that opportunity.
Right. I mean, I think one of the questions that was posed by the series is basically, do you have to accept, you know, turning a blind eye to the behavior of your players off the field to be as successful as the 2000 Huskies were? And granting that we didn't know all this stuff at the time, we knew some of it, but we certainly didn't know anywhere near all of it. It feels like what we've seen in the Chris Peterson era in particular shows that that's a false choice, that's not a choice you have to make.
I definitely agree that that's not a choice you have to make. But at the same time, there's levels to this and there are factors to this, which are there are not equal conditions for young black males and young white males in a sport that is predominantly dominated by young black men, right? So,
I mean, one of the things we've heard repeatedly is, especially, you know, imposing black men are inherently seen as a threat by the rest of society. And that's what football players fall into that category.
By default, basically fall into that category. There's no way that we can actually judge that subjectively. But also at the same time, I think everybody can be held to high standards. And I think it would be offensive to say that this is a trade-off that you have to make, right? If you're like, if you want to have a good football team, you have to accept there's going to be some bad apples. And that to me feels like SEC logic. Like that doesn't make sense to me. There are scenarios that I don't think are equitable. And, you know, you can sort of litigate those things as they come. But like the idea that it's just like, oh, you're going to have a bunch of bad guys playing for a football team, that I cannot agree with.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
But I do think a lot of this, you know, let's say it's 2020. You know, the whole world is going to look different. And well, actually, the whole world's going to look exactly the fucking same as it did in the year 2000 with regards to policing. But we're going to understand things a little bit differently.
Well, the world is going to look very different because it turns out there was not a pandemic in 2000.
Shit don't matter. Cops don't care.
All right, scouting the opponents, the Stanford Cardinal had regressed after their first Rose Bowl appearance since 1971 under our old friend Tyrone Willingham. They beat number 5 Texas in non-conference play, but also lost at home to San Jose State and were 3-4 entering the UW game. Carter was really the only player of note on the offense, although they still had a lot of defensive talent with Tank Williams and Coy Wire, who go on to NFL careers. Arizona, who they played the subsequent week, started Pac-10 play 3-0 with wins at Stanford and at number 18 USC, but had lost back-to-back games to Oregon and UCLA before entering the UW game at 5-3. And longtime UW nemesis Ortiz Jenkins, returning to Husky Stadium for the first time since the flip to win that game in 98, was in his last season as starting quarterback for the Wildcats. And because it was 2000, of course he completed 47% of his passes. How the games went. The Stanford led that game 6-0 in Palo Alto after the first quarter, but the Huskies scored 24 and answered to take his seemingly insurmountable lead with 5:57 remaining. The Cardinal, and I did not realize this, then went touchdown, onside kick recovery, touchdown, onside kick recovery, touchdown, with a third onside kick recovery negated by penalty in the midst of that they had to re-kick to take a 28-24 lead with 53 seconds remaining.
How easy were onside kicks in the year 2000?
No, seems like it should have been an issue for the Huskies special teams. The Huskies then, and this is the only part of the game I remember because I'm assuming I must have been working that day. I don't know if we've talked about that. I was like working every other Saturday during the 2000 season.
God, which is not Boulevard great. Park Library.
Yeah, and this game started at 2.
You worked every day forever, man. Think about look, we don't have to remember some years, and maybe this instilled something in you. Think about how much life you missed out on by working at the Boulevard Park Library every Saturday for your entire life, and how little that, whatever, 10, 13 an hour matters to you now. Right?
It's true. I mean, if I could have done it without missing the Husky games, I would have been fine. The Huskies then, so I got off at 5, and I remember listening have been to like the final play, final drive.
Ever.
The Huskies marched 80 yards on 3 plays in 36 seconds, capped by a Justin Robbins TD with 17 seconds remaining to win this game, which was pretty incredible. The Huskies then at home trailed Arizona 25-10 midway through the third quarter before scoring 17 unanswered points to take the lead in that one. The Wildcats reclaimed a 32-27 lead with 4:48 left on a 51-yard touchdown run. The Huskies then drove 57 yards on 11 plays, culminating in Marcus Tuiasosopo 2-yard touchdown run with 1:10 left, and finished the game by blocking a potential tying 51-yard field goal on the final play by Anthony Vontour, a cornerback who is another tragic story from the 2000 team. Dismissed from the team after the season after a series of suspensions, Vontour was believed to be bipolar by the coaching staff and, you know, people who had worked with him, though he apparently was never diagnosed as such. In 2002, while he was living in Sacramento, police were called after witnesses said Vontour was screaming at 4 a.m. that men in green masks were coming to get him. Handcuffed by police and placed in a police car, Vontour died after a struggle, and his family settled a $25 million lawsuit against the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department for $20,000 in 2006, which was used to fund a scholarship at his alma mater, De La Salle High School. So,
are you kidding me?
I am not.
How do I not know about this?
It got a lot of run at the time, but yeah, I got to be honest, I had not thought about it until I reread that the Victory and Ruin series.
Let me just go back to what I said earlier about inequity in policing. Let me just say, if I don't know, Benji Olsen or whatever, I don't know who is on this team.
Cody Pickett.
Yeah, was he a freshman at the time?
He played in the Rose Bowl.
If Cody Pickett was involved in a struggle with police, let's just say the scenario might have turned out differently.
Yeah, it was interesting. His former coach at De La Salle, the legend Bob Lettiser, who
This was in Sacramento as well.
It's Concord, so it's just outside. It's near there, but in that area. Mm-hmm. And that's a school that had the record winning streak that Bellevue High School snapped at CenturyLink Field in like 2003. He brought this up after, you know, George Floyd's death and in the midst of the protests. So really? Certainly he seems to connect it to the police's role.
Who was that?
The coach.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Let me just put this out there. There's no reason that anybody involved in a, quote, struggle with police should end up dead after that.
How the rest of the season went, Stanford lost 37-35 at UCLA the following week to be eliminated from bowl eligibility before winning their last two games to finish 5-6. Arizona finished on a 5-game losing streak to also finish 5-6, and longtime coach Dick Tomey, who most famously was part of the Desert Swarm team that ended the Huskies' undefeated streak in 1992, resigned after the season. Arizona would not get back to a bowl game again until 2008. All right, let's wrap up by talking about the Seahawks coming off that win on Sunday.
Serious.
I told you it was going to be some real talk.
I had not, you prepared me for one part, but the Anthony Vontour part was not, I always liked him. I honestly had no idea that that had happened.
Yeah. I mean, it's the tragedy is that the fact that we don't remember it, really. All right, the Seahawks head into their bye week 5-0, first in the NFC West, first in the NFC before Green Bay, which is also 4-0 plays. And Football Outsiders now gives the Seahawks the best chance at the number one seed in the NFC and the one bye this season at 36%, with the Packers at 20%. Seahawks 57% to win the division and 93% to make the playoffs, second behind Kansas City.
Is it wrong that I'm still nervous?
No, absolutely not. 93% is still 7% they die. It's better than, it's probably less than Minnesota's win probability was at some point on Sunday night.
I mean, I swear to God, I approach the situation as like, all right, there are three wildcard teams. That means things look pretty good.
A reasonable take.
This is not even a Seahawks take. This is a being a sports fan take. You don't know what's going to happen until it happens. And you just want to assume the worst.
This is also a season where it's probably not advisable to have an early bye because of the possibility that your schedule could get ruined by, hopefully, knock on wood, not an outbreak on your team, but an outbreak on another team could cause that. There was like 7 schedule changes last week because of the Patriots-Broncos game getting moved.
Were there really?
That's what I think I remember.
Oh my God.
Like there's a cascading series of schedule changes. And once you have your bye week, there's been a Tuesday night game now.
There's 2 Monday night games coming up. And then you see on this Tuesday, multiple teams with players reporting to the injured reserve / COVID-19 list. So a lot of question marks throughout the league. But Russ is cooking. And most importantly for the Seahawks, they have gotten through these first 5 weeks, despite the fact that I have told you every single week in these post-game pods, I feel like an idiot for saying we could be undefeated going into the bye week. The Seahawks are going into the bye week undefeated.
There it is.
Somehow, some way, they have seen the darkness over and over and over again. They have faced Cam Newton with one play, a scramble that he had every single time to score, to beat them. They have faced Dak Prescott coming down the field, trying to tie it up. They have faced the Minnesota Vikings in the rain. Russell Wilson has been touched by rain and have managed. I mean, honestly, if we're looking back on this, they've faced the Miami Dolphins, who throttled the 49ers this last week. I think one of the things you have to look at is, and we talked about this a little bit in the postgame pod, the Seahawks have not faced an easy schedule through these first 5 weeks. And the gauntlet is awaiting for a lot of other teams throughout the NFC West. It's not the hardest chunk of the schedule is still ahead, I think, for the Seahawks.
There is a gauntlet, but there's also some soft underbelly of the schedule awaiting.
Every other team in the NFC West has faced one of the Giants or the Jets. And if you're fortunate enough to be in a division that is going to face the Giants and the Jets, like, those are clearly the easiest games in the schedule. Plus Washington, like, the Seahawks have eminently winnable games near the end of the schedule. So
that is correct.
I look at it and I say to myself, I think they can confidently get to 9-7.
The hardest stretch will be starting at the start of November. They travel to Arizona after the bye, and then following that, San Francisco, at Buffalo, at LA Rams. Not great.
But the good thing about that is you don't know what these teams are going to look like at the time. Almost never do teams get significantly better throughout the year.
Like, I think the 49ers are going to get significantly better throughout the year. Given their injuries.
I'm saying this more like weeks 13, 14, 15. You're not like, well, the Giants are going to be amazing by week 13.
No, I agree with that.
I mean this more in that regard. Where it's like, and also, you know, the Niners in week 8 are different than the Niners in week 2. Like, it's a different roster. But I think the way that this shapes up, the Seahawks can confidently make the playoffs.
93 felt a little low to me, but there's a lot of randomness still to happen. The Seahawks are 3rd in DVOA this week, 3rd in offense, 18th in defense, which speaks to your comment after the on the emergency pod that they're a little bit underrated on defense because of the slate of opposing offenses they've played. And then fourth in special teams, which we really haven't talked much about outside of maybe some of the Michael Dixon punts.
I mean, special teams have been damn near perfect, right?
Pete Carroll pointed out they have not, knock on wood, had a penalty on special teams all season, which is wild.
They have not missed a kick. Michael Dixon.
They've only taken what? I mean, I guess there's been a lot of extra points, but they've only taken two field goals, right?
Michael Dixon has been basically perfect when he's been called on. They haven't given up a long return. You know, I don't know if kick returning has been much of anything, punt returning, whatever, but like the safe parts of special teams, they've just held it down. Like, this is a Pete Carroll team more than we've seen in a while from Pete Carroll. Of like, they're doing the things that Pete Carroll really would like them to do, aside from, of course, playing defense. But like the fundamental aspects of football, they're doing quite well right now.
Yeah, they're just not screwing up the things you can really screw up.
Do you have any lingering thoughts from this thrilling 27-26 victory against the Vikings on Sunday night?
Not particularly, but it sounds like you do.
Well, we have to talk about Travis Homer for a second.
I don't get it. I don't know why this is such a big talking point. Your third string running back?
Third string running back?
Yeah, Carlos Hyde was injured. I don't know if you're aware of this. He's going to be healthy after the bye.
Okay, how about this?
And also, actually, he's the four-string running back, because I don't know if you're aware of this. There's this guy named Rashad Penny who plays for the Seahawks.
Oh.
And at some point after week six, he'll be eligible to be activated from the pup list.
Man, would love some Rashad Penny action right now, right?
Yeah.
Can everybody please chill the fuck out? Right? Like, the Seahawks have the best record they've ever had after five games. This is everything that is going on is an unmitigated success.
But that's why. It's because you can't complain about the usual things. So you're down to, in this case, fourth string running back who's been elevated to second string by injuries.
The one thing that I can admit from it is, we said this in the post game pod. If you're going to play Travis Homer on the entire final drive, you have to be comfortable handing him the ball. And maybe you're not with Travis Homer, but like,
I think they were. I mean, I don't think it was a great situation to run, because where did they get the first in goal? What was it, like the 8? The 6? That's not a place where you should be running.
First down.
You think that is a place you should be running?
No, it's not a great situation to be running, but if they're not expecting a run at all, I wouldn't have been shocked with a run to just pull off a touchdown there.
Sure. Ryan Tannehill had one tonight.
Look, we can have a running back like Tannehill.
We can't all have Ryan Tannehill. Yes, it was at the 6-yard line.
I mean, a surprise draw or whatever. If it's
but
Carson,
like it would have required you to draw, take a timeout. So you couldn't have done that until third down, right?
You wanted to run the clock there. I'm sorry, but I don't know if you know this. The Vikings had 15 seconds left on the clock.
Yeah, Seahawks, but you don't want to risk a sack when you're out of timeouts.
You don't risk a sack. You take the time.
With 20 seconds?
There wasn't 20 seconds.
By fourth down, there were 20 seconds.
Anyway, this is irrelevant. It's just like, can we just cool the fuck out and be happy about this? We have possibly the best receiver in the NFL. At the very least, the best young receiver in the NFL. Like, all of the misses. I mean, you mentioned this about the Seahawks drafting. It's like, look, they've made some mistakes on the defensive end with draft picks, but like, they drafted DK Metcalf.
I wouldn't
right?
say that
like,
about LJ Collier anymore. LJ Collier living up to the hype.
LJ Collier has reached a level of competent, you know? Like, I just, there's nothing we can be upset about in this moment.
I agree with that.
That's it. Let's just be happy. Team. Like, this team is ranked 3rd in DVOA, and they shouldn't be ranked 3rd in DVOA. They are ranked 3rd. As of preseason, if you would have said we were 5-0 and ranked third in DVOA, you would say more than sign me up. You'd be like, no way that that's the case. If you were like Brian Schottenheimer and Pete Carroll, let Russ cook, like, we could just be happy.
They have the number one pass rate on early downs in the NFL. Like, what the fuck, man? Where did that come from?
It is a beautiful thing what's happening right now in Seattle. And that's it.
Except for the loss of landmarks.
Bask in the moment. Look, fuck the elephant car wash. We have Russell Wilson.
Oh, no.
Right?
It's not unfair.
Like, just fucking tear down the PI globe. We have that KJ Wright interception. That's all we need.
You're going to put a photo of the KJ Wright interception, a statue of the KJ Wright interception on top of the PI building?
It was an amazing play. KJ Wright may be the most underrated player from this current run. But, like, this is amazing what we're witnessing. This is 2013 style amazing what we're witnessing.
I would say Travis Homer is the most underappreciated from this run. he's very unappreciated.
You also, the thing is, you can't.
Actually, you know who the most underappreciated is for this run?
Who's that?
You know who it is. It's Jermaine Kearse.
Ah. Have him raise the 12th man flag, San Francisco, week 8. You can't both think that running backs don't matter and also be so upset about a running back and have them matter.
I'm not sure the people who are arguing about this really think running backs don't matter.
I don't even know if this is people arguing about it. I just can't tell, or if it's even a joke. But, like,
I think people are just bored because the bye week is like a mini offseason.
It's great. Like, having a week that the Niners and the Rams play each other and the Seahawks are just undefeated. We've managed to get to a week where we're cheering for the 49ers.
Unadulterated red zone.
It's just been a really fun, when you're just talking about this Seahawks specifically, not anything else that's circling around them. It's been a really fun year.
Not the ongoing outbreaks.
No, the 215,000 people dead. The ongoing outbreaks, whatever. Like, the Seahawks are the only 5-0 team. And they still have pieces to get back. You know, they'll have possibly Snacks on the active roster. Josh Gordon is coming back. Rashad Penny, like you mentioned. Like, there's
Jamal Adams?
Jamal Adams didn't play 40% of the games they've played. Jamal Adams did not play in. And you really have to sort of, like, distill it down to none of this other shit matters. Like, there's one player that matters, and that's really it. Give Russell Wilson targets, and
give him a roof.
Don't even give him a roof. Whatever, he don't need it. But, like, give Russell Wilson a healthy Tyler Lockett, a bunch of tight ends. I just
wait. Appropriately celebrate Thrill Dissly getting his first touchdown since his injury.
There we go.
Today is the 1-year anniversary of Will Dissly rupturing his Achilles.
Wow, this is when I was flying back from San Francisco.
That's correct. I was sitting
airport, maybe the most hungover I've ever been in my entire life. No, not actually.
That seems like a very high bar. I was at a sports bar in Oakland watching this game. With no one else who cared.
Missing the first half of that game. And the Seahawks is coming down, really beating the shit out of the Browns. I'm so impressed with the beginning of the season. And I don't think that the Seahawks have overextended themselves that much. They're not sitting in cap hell. The draft capital is not quite as good as you would like it to be post Jamal Adams trade. But, like, when you look around the NFC West, you say to yourself, the Rams and the 49ers are in pretty bad long-term situations. They have quarterbacks that nobody can feel that confident in, locked up for large amounts of money. And it's like things are shaping up nicely for the Seahawks, as little as I want to admit it.
Oh boy.
That's it.
Yeah,
so we get a little break. We get to watch Rams Niners and I guess cheer for the Rams. And then, you know, division play starts in week 7. And it's kind of, you know, I think, like you were saying, those weeks 7 through 11, maybe 12, that's kind of go time for the year. That's when we'll know whether the Seahawks are going to be the one seed in the NFC or whether they're going to be the, you know, two seed or be a wild card. Like, we will know during that time period because things get a lot easier after that. There's a 3-4 game stretch of very easy games. And this is the gauntlet they're going to face.
All right. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Man, playing the Cardinals on a Thursday night at home, I think that's actually like the perfect scenario. If you were to drop a scenario,
it's not a Sunday afternoon with Chris Myers on the call.
Exactly. Like, that's the worst case for them to play the Cardinals at home is fucking week 16 or 17. And like just a gloomy Sunday afternoon. Give us the Cardinals on national TV.
I mean, they did lose to them on Sunday Night Football one time.
That was different, though. That was okay. A good Cardinals team.
I don't think it even rained that day. Did it rain?
No, you were at that game, right?
Yeah. We were at that game together.
Was Chris there?
He was not. Must have been the season he didn't go.